All right, so our agenda is there. Today on the call, we have strict mode for the API, data round tripping, more specific frame matching. I thought we discussed that last week, though. Maybe I accidentally put that back on. Introduction of an extension keyword, how graph is going to be supported in framing, embed behavior. And that's kind of an important one to kind of look at, and then expanding type to ID objects and expanded form. Do we have any updates or changes to the agenda? Anything that we should discuss before these ones? Nope. All right, let's go ahead and jump into it. I guess I do have one question, and that's on finishing up the JSON. So technically I'm on vacation this week, but I was going to spend it editing the JSON-LD spec, or maybe putting any last-minute changes that we need to put into it before we kind of propose that the RDF working group takes it up. The first question is, do we feel that the JSON-LD syntax is stable enough that we can finalize that document, more or less finalize the document, and then propose it to the RDF working group? And then the second question is, if so, then what should be focused on in that document? Do we feel it's pretty much ready, or do we need to do some other cleanups to the document? And I guess Marcus and Greg, you guys might know the status of the document at this point.
Well, I think there's one issue in the issue tracker. I think it's the last in today's agenda, which might be syntax related. So if we expand type objects, but that's really an expansion.
Right. And yeah. So sorry. Go ahead.
And yeah, I mean the other one is the grammar, the allowed grammar, which is never formally defined anywhere in the document, I think.
Right. Yep.
So that's missing, I think.
Okay.
That was the other issue we talked about last week.
Right.
So I hadn't time to update the tickets.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, I think that we could create a section for the grammar and then finalize it when we propose it to the RDF working group, saying that it's kind of a it's not front and center. It's not like introducing a new keyword or anything like that. And then the type issue, I think, is also something that we could discuss when it's presented to the RDF working group. So keep in mind that, you know, when we present it to the RDF working group, it doesn't have to be done, but we at least have to have a pretty good idea of there, you know, being outstanding issues, or if there are outstanding issues, how we are going to go about resolving it. I think you're absolutely right, Marcus. But I don't think that should prevent us from trying to finalize it as much as possible and present it to the RDF working group. And I think what we could do is put two issue markers for the issues that you just mentioned, Marcus. Would that be enough? I mean, do we feel that with that, then we'll basically say, okay, everyone, you know, start tearing it apart, look at the syntax document and tell us what you think, and then we're going to try and do a first public working draft through the RDF working group with that document.
How will the one? It's pretty complete. Sorry.
Okay.
How will the process be once it goes into the RDF working group?
We don't really know.
No.
I think the way that it would typically go. If we were normally the W3C would do like a task force and we would create something and then we would propose what we've created back to the group. So we're assuming that that's more or less how we're going to be operating. So we're going to say, you know, here's the JSON-LD syntax document. We believe it's more or less ready to be finalized through the RDF working group and then published, you know, and published as a RecTrack document. So then the chairs would take a look at it and see, you know, whether or not they agree that it should be discussed in that group. We would move, we would try and get all of us into the RDF working group so that we can, you know, discuss it and explain why certain decisions were made. We do almost immediately a first public working draft through the W3C process, and then you know, the RDF working group would raise a number of issues on the spec that they wanted to see addressed. We would attempt to address all of those and then go and do effectively a last call and get last call comments, and we'd do a candidate recommendation to get implementations, which we already have more or less two. It's going to be a bit strange with implementations because it's not something that is really, you know, I mean, it's just a grammar, right? There's no real test suite. The only test suite we have is on the API compaction expansion and making sure that you get the triples that you expect. You could argue that maybe to and from RDF could be the test suite. But then, you know, that's in the RDF API document, and then that would, you know, that would mean that we depend on it. So we'd have to figure out how we think the candidate recommendation phase should go. And then once that's done, we do, you know, propose rec and then finally rec. And we're hopefully it's going to be a much tighter release schedule than RDFA, because RDFA we had to deal with a lot of external, you know, implementations and companies and all that kind of stuff, whereas JSON-LD, it's not necessarily that.
But do we expect that, I mean, when we go into this, we want this to be so finished that it's not, it won't be a discussion. There are issues, the potential issues that will be raised, we don't expect them to be of the kind that will sort of change the shape of things or introduce keywords.
We hope not. And in fact, you know, all of the people in this group, the, you know, the people on the call, all of us need to get on the same page before we go to the RDF working group, because if there's some disagreement between us, it's going to be multiplied in the RDF working group. So we have to have our story pretty straight before we go to the RDF working group. And I think we more or less have that. There are some key, there are a couple of things like floating out there. Like I know that Marcus and Longley and Greg have implemented compaction in a particular way, and there's still some disagreement there. But I don't think that disagreement is going to reflect in the actual syntax. I don't think we're going to make syntax changes because of it. I think we're going to make algorithmic changes potentially because of that disagreement. But if, for example, we have a fundamental disagreement on what graph is or means, then that could potentially be expanded out into a 5-month discussion in the RDF working group, which we don't want to happen. And really, named graphs is that's the potential there. We're basically injecting something into a language, this graph support, that the RDF working group is still actively discussing just the core fundamental concepts on. So it could be a positive thing in that we have introduced something that that helps them make a decision, or we could be throwing a grenade into, you know, their group, which would just completely it would hold up everything. So I think another thing that we've discussed with some of the W3C team and the chairs is the possibility of moving the JSON-LD. If for some reason JSON-LD gets stuck in some kind of, you know, quagmire in the RDF working group and we're not making the progress that we'd want to see, they might create a new group for JSON-LD if it has backing from W3C company or W3C members. So that's another option.
Yvonne mentioned that the RDF Web Apps working group would be
potentially.
I mean,
potentially. I'm a bit. I would like there to be many more eyes on this than just that group. And I think putting it, at least temporarily, putting it into the RDF working group would make that happen. You know, go ahead.
Yeah, it makes sense since they originally had RDF JSON, and they, well, one of the editors wanted JSON LD instead in there, as I, if I understand.
Right, exactly.
So it makes sense to start there and then maybe, as you say, go into another mode of operations if there are too many things going on at the same time in that group.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly the rationale that's being used right now.
Well, will there be a way back if we go in there?
What do you mean by way back?
You can't normally move it around between different working groups, can you?
You can. You can. That happened with HTML plus RDFA, kind of. I mean, it's the nice thing about W3C is that they tend to be very flexible. They want to see people making progress, and if for some reason something gets stuck, for whatever reason, they try and find a way to get it moving again. I'm confident that if for whatever reason it gets stuck, we can get it unstuck through W3C process. And in the absolute worst case, there's still a spec out there and people can still implement it and use it. So it doesn't, you know, W3C doesn't need to put their stamp on it for people to start using it. But it certainly helps if that happens. So I think we've got, you know, we've got a couple of contingencies if disasters happen, but I think it's less likely that for a disaster to happen with JSON LD than it is for something like HTML plus RDFA, right? That you're putting it into a group that has like hundreds of members and all of them have their own opinion on what you know data is in documents and all that kind of stuff. Whereas JSON LD is a little more confined to developers and people that use JSON and JavaScript and things like that.
There may be some. I mean, we've seen hints of very different perspectives on how people want to use this, but I think that the shape of it as it is today is pretty much what is the middle ground between people. I mean, in the expanded form, it looks fairly close to RDF JSON,
mm-hmm.
So possibly that's good enough. Then
yeah.
Again, I mean, the RDF heads, as I myself admittedly am, might have the similar problems with the overloaded meaning of type.
Yeah.
That might be something that we have to really get right when we send it to them so that it's just not torn up again. And I probably wouldn't mind reintroducing data type because I wanted it, but I think that we might try to make the case convincing, the current case convincing enough so that we might not have to deal with that immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, I think we would be guessing about what they might say, and I'm concerned that we're just going to, you know, we might end up spending a lot of time thinking that the data type issue is a big deal when people kind of shrug it off and say, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And then they fixate on something else like, you know, expanded form or you know, that expanded form isn't indexed by, you know, pick whatever we don't do. Someone wants that, you know, that to be the way that it's done. So I think I think that there's absolutely nobody in that group that is disingenuous about what they want to see. Like they're not going to try and trip us up just for the sake of tripping us up. So let's just get their, you know, we can just say, look, this is what we have right now. Let's get their feedback. And if there's a lot of negative feedback, then we might want to kind of regroup and figure out how to address the feedback. But if it's, you know, if people seem like it, think that it's okay, then we might push it forward. I know a couple of people in that group have read it, and the comments back have mostly been like grammatical fixes and changes, sentence flow. It's not anything conceptual. So that's a good sign. And these people like Pat Hayes, who has a very, you know, he definitely knows his stuff. I think we at this point, you know, we can just present it and say, hey, what do you guys think, and then kind of go from there.
So that would mean we present it without the API document, right?
Yeah, initially, and then I'm sure people will start asking questions about, well, how exactly does this work, or how exactly does this transform into RDF, and then we can point to the API document. But I think that the argument here is that, look, we're putting out a syntax. We're putting out a syntax. We're not putting out the API document yet because we want to make sure that, you know, people are using the API and programming with it before we finalize it. And there's no connection. There's supposed to be no connection between the syntax and the API. So hopefully that will give people enough of an idea of how this stuff works behind the scenes to understand that the syntax is solid and would support an API. And then we can see if they believe that that's enough, or if they feel that the API absolutely should be rec track along with the syntax, which would be a bit strange, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. People might yet need time to figure out how to do framing and, all kinds of, I mean, both Josh and I seem to have a kind of similar approach to the at least pseudo-automatic framing that we've done in our specific use cases. So we should have some slack there for different IDs to coalesce properly and be formalized.
Yep.
I think if we don't hit some of these issues, such as framing, people are going to get there, particularly if we look at the RDF conversion algorithms is going to expanded form, which probably isn't interesting for people to use except in the presence of framing or at least compaction. So that could certainly lead to, I think, a lot of discussion about people about, well, how should the RDF conversion work in order to go between different RDF formats, so not being able to have an API deck to expect to reference could just create more issues.
Well, I guess we could, the document's there, right? They can go and look at it. I think the only question is whether or not there's a normative link between the JSON-LD syntax and the JSON-LD API. Does that seem like a reasonable way to approach it, Greg, to basically say, look, there's still an open question on whether or not we should have a normative link to the API spec. The reason we didn't do that is for reasons X, Y, and Z. Do people agree with that, or do you think that we really should, take the API and the syntax to rec at the same time?
Do we have a normative link in there now or not?
No, I don't. Well, we're not supposed to. So I think the idea is that we shouldn't. At least this is what Yvonne wants. Yvonne doesn't want us to have a normative link between the two documents because he thinks that. For very good reason, right? We want to make sure that the syntax is out there, and then we can talk about how the API operates on the syntax, or rather, we can have a document there, but it's not rec until we have more implementations and more people using it out in the field.
I agree with that.
Right. So I think that's the reason we don't want a normative link in there. But if people in the RDF working group feel differently, then we're going to have to really work on finalizing it and doing it in such a way that we can change it, because inevitably it's going to need to be changed if we take it to rec too quickly.
Well, I guess one of my concerns is sort of following some of the current traffic in the group there relating to named graphs. It seems like as they go on, they create more and more issues, but there's seems to be some resistance to settling a subset of those issues. It's sort of like, well, we have to settle them all at once.
Yeah.
And I think if JSON-LD goes in and there's various issues relating to a non-normative API, then that just might cause us to spin until all of that is done. It sort of this might be different because that's a dynamic of a portion of the group that's working on core semantics syntax doesn't seem to be, the turtle stuff doesn't seem to be quite so kinetic, but it's possible, given the personalities, that we could get into some quagmire.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to us all being on the same page. And if there are, you know, if there are four people that are saying we need to resolve this, this is exactly how we resolve it, or, you know, we don't care about what the IRI identifies, where nobody is saying we should use something that's not an IRI, so let's just use an IRI, and you guys can figure out exactly what that means or in what context it's like a graph snapshot versus a, you know, a layer versus whatever, you know, terminology they end up using. So I think the way that we address that, Greg, is we basically say, you know, we go in there and say, look, we believe JSON-LD needs these features. If one of them is named graph support or whatever you want to call it, we have spec'd out something that we think is useful for people, right? The core semantics of it can be, you know, discussed and figured out later, but to us, this is what it means, right? I mean, we identify a named graph using an IRI. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a snapshot in time. It can always specify a kind of a graph that's out there, that's a graph container, effectively, that's changing all the time. So I do agree with you that there's a danger that happens, but I think that we can correct that danger because up until now, I don't feel like they've really had a concrete kind of need for it to be done, right? And so JSON-LD kind of puts this concrete pressure on them to say, look, here's a solution. Nobody else is presenting a different solution for JSON that does this, you know, anything differently. Or rather, we've looked at them and all of them have been tossed to the side. So this is the solution that we're looking at. And then just basically get upvotes or downvotes on it. And see you know if there's consensus to move forward with that solution. I know that's a bit heavy-handed, but it's also, you know, I mean, we can't continue to discuss this stuff ad nauseum. I don't know if you agree with that or not, Greg.
Well, yeah, I guess my concern is that the flavor of the month maybe is layers. Or something like that, and mm-hmm. I'm worried about those concepts infecting, you know, syntax and making it more complicated for people. Mm-hmm. Graph is already a well-known concept from Sparkle, mm-hmm. and there's been some talk about introducing graph in either Turtle or Trig.
Yeah.
And I think if we were to add a layer keyword, what would that really bring us?
Yeah.
I just can't imagine that would help matters at all.
I have a feeling that, I mean, so I think that what we'd end up doing is we would all just vote, you know, straw poll -1 on that, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's something that's just we believe is unnecessary, at least I think we believe is unnecessary for JSON-LD, and we want to keep it really tight and simple, and we believe that would create way more complexity than is required by most, you know, developers that use JSON.
Well, these are all hypotheticals. I think the key is let's as soon as we can move the, you know, get this moved into the group there so that we can
right.
have substantive discussions. I don't really feel that anywhere in this group there's significant divergence on certainly the core syntax level,
mm-hmm.
or even on the expected, you know, behavior of the API.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as editors, it's, you know, there's disagreements on how things should be, how should be discussed,
right.
But that's part of the process of coming out with good text for doing that.
Right. Yeah. I feel like even with the API at this point, we're talking about, you know, implementation, really, really specific implementation details, and not, you know, questions like should JSON-LD have an API, and, you know, do we really need a compact method call, and, you know, how do we pass options to that you know, method call? So I agree. I don't think that there's any major divergence. There isn't divergence to the point that it would cause a problem in the RDF working group, at least as far as, you know, us saying this is what the position, you know, this is what our position is collectively. Marcus, Nicholas, do you guys agree or disagree, or do you feel like there's a point where we fundamentally disagree on something in the syntax or the API?
No, as you said, in the API it's more or less just details and what the defaults basically are, but I think we all agree more or less on the general principles, and the same goes, well, even more for the syntax. I think there's, well, agreement about almost everything. It's maybe just if, for example, objects are allowed for a type, but
right,
that doesn't really affect the syntax. It just allows something or disallows something. So it's,
right,
I mean, the syntax is there, and I think it's stable enough.
Okay.
With a possible reservation for that, this the issue 120 about types. It's in my mind possibly a hint that our overloading of type is problematic, but I'm not strong about that perspective.
Right, right. And it might help to get some input from the RDF working group. It might help and might hurt. I mean, you know, it could go either way.
It's about mindsets. I mean, for me, you know, data type means something so intrinsic that I have had a hard time doing that originally. But when I manage and I have another perspective on it, I certainly see all the arguments in favor of it. I just can't guess how set the mindsets are in that group.
Right. And I guess, I mean, really, the argument isn't how set the mindset is in the RDF working group. It's how set the mindset is for the JSON developer that's going to be using this language.
I got a question. As far as getting people to accept this, the work we've done, should we put some more work into that primer? I know I started it a long time ago, and it's completely out of date and kind of bogus right now, but
I think it would help. I mean, we don't have a primer for JSON-LD, and I think right. What I mean is we don't have an up-to-date one that we've got along the, you know, that we're planning to publish along with this document. If you could update that spec or update the primer that you're working on, that would be great. I think that would help.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering what the perspective of those other people are when they first look at the spec. Because, I mean, when I first look at something and I see a primer, I look at that first because it usually gives you a taste of the idea without, you know, jumping straight into all the technical details. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if people saw that and understood how we tried to make this stuff be used, that they'd be, oh, well, you know, that makes a lot of sense, as opposed to just being like, what the hell is this compact stuff, and so on.
I haven't heard anything negative about not being able to understand what the JSON-LD spec does, other than people, you know, in the Pacewarm group who don't really understand, you know, the whole linked data stuff, group.
Yeah, I assume that audience is actually, you know, a little bit more familiar with all the concepts that we're trying to address.
Right. I mean, I think ideally we would have a primer. Ideally, we'd have a primer and we'd be able to say, look at the primer first. It's a quick 15-minute read. And then once you've looked at that, you can look at the syntax. But I guess the beginning of the syntax document, though, is kind of like a little mini primer, right? There's a portion of the syntax document where we're like, hey, this is a JSON, you know, here's a JSON object. We want to transform it into linked data. How do we do that? So there are a couple of paragraphs in the beginning that kind of give you a gentle introduction to it, but certainly not at the level that a primer would.
Right. I actually wasn't really sure how to approach it when I started writing it. I kind of did it from the novice JSON programmer. How do I make my data into linked data?
I think that is the best. That would be the best way to do it because I think that those are the types of people we want using JSON-LD. We're not trying to make RDF people use JSON. We're trying to make JSON people use linked data.
Right.
So yeah, I think that would be the. Ahead.
Yeah. Do we have some place to collect use cases like? I don't recall that I've seen them.
We don't, but
we're going to put a wiki up.
We could. I mean, the issue with wikis that I've found with the spec stuff is that not very many people edit them. Like we'll have, you know, the people in the group edit them, and then once we stop editing the wiki, it just kind of stops. We could put up a wiki. It's just whenever I've done this in the past and we've done it for multiple specs, people just end up not editing it. I was thinking that hopefully everyone here has commit rights to the website, and that's where we would put, you know, someone would work on a really quick page, like this is how you mark up a person in JSON-LD, and just add it to the website so that people could kind of look at those. So I don't know. I don't think we really need a wiki to do that, or rather, the overhead of a wiki is a bit overkill for at least what I've seen traditionally happen with this sort of stuff.
I think, yeah, if we just had an area on the website for examples, and we do have examples in the playground, and maybe the way to do that is sort of what we did in the Linter, where we have an extended examples out of there, or we have something else with the examples that allows you to see them and then pull them up in the playground quickly to sort of play with them a little bit.
The test cases presented as something that's easy to see help too.
Yeah, being able to expose the test cases would give an awful lot of examples from people, but the test cases don't make good examples because they're tended to look at details. But I think as a way of people to sort of just browse through and see things, I think that's not a bad idea.
I have two things popped up in my head which I should really write down somewhere, and I figured they might be good to present somewhere, either as they might be bigger than use cases, they might be more like stories, where one would be a generalized version of the approach I took for the legal information stuff, which could be sort of like how to store schema.org data into Elasticsearch, which would be just how you build your own search engine upon the schema.org or SIOC or things like that.
Right.
So how you consume data with...
Yeah, I think that would be great. I mean, those are like kind of testimonials I don't know. It's not really a testimonial, like you said. It's more of a kind of a how-to.
Yeah. And the other one is, I think Greg has approached it already when we are discussing things like templating and how to generate... model vocabulary documentation using normal templating systems, where it's very nice to be able to send work in JSON instead of the expanded form of stuff.
From so many things that I've got to do, which sort of previously involved getting turtle documents, doing queries over them, and then putting that into some object form that allows me to deal with it easily. The JSON-LD is just much easier. For instance, I did this standalone RDFA test runner the other day, which sort of based upon work I'd done on my own, which parsed the RDF and then created objects associated with the tests and then iterated over them. The new one is much easier to just basically read in the JSON-LD and iterate over the data structures that are in there. It was much faster, too. So,
good.
Yeah, we can just reference. I think I've got a reasonable write-up on how it was used on my website. And, Nicholas, perhaps if you did a similar write-up for your use cases, then we can just have some place on the JSON LD site that we can reference those, or we could even just pull them in as sort of extended quotes too.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So you guys, I just checked, and everyone here has access to commit rights to the website. So I think just whoever gets to it first, just create a page for examples, and we can kind of go from there. And we can always reorganize the website if it starts to get too complicated or too heavy on any particular page.
Yeah, I think the only other thing is linking those examples back into the playground.
Yep.
And I'm not exactly sure what would be involved in doing that. But
I had an idea for an examples page that would list a whole bunch of examples on the left-hand side. And then when you clicked on it, without refreshing the page or whatever, it would just make an AJAX fetch out to the JSON LD. It would run it through a JSON LD processor and colorize it and then kind of show what the output is. Kind of have the playground embedded in the examples rather than the other way around. So you wouldn't have to leave the examples.
You don't need to AJAX request, right? Because you can do that entirely.
That's true. Yep.
On the web page.
Yep, that's true.
Have you thought about taking some of the stuff you did in the RDFA playground?
Yeah. I think a lot of it
stuff's pretty cool.
Yeah, it would really simplify it, and it would be fairly quote unquote simple to do. It's just finding the time. I'm not trying not to overload my vacation too much with doing clerk related.
I think
you
can
like
wait
that.
Till you're back from vacation.
Right. In any case, it would simplify the playground code. It would make it look much nicer. Moving the entire site over to Bootstrap would be really nice as well. I mean, all that stuff needs to be done. It's just finding the time to do it.
Well, of course, I will volunteer to step in and help out.
Okay.
But I'm not as familiar with how that stuff works. So.
Okay. Yeah. It should be fairly simple to. Well, yeah, it should be fairly simple. It's just a couple of. It's like a weekend of work to update the entire site to what we did with the RDFA stuff.
Did the RDFA stuff in 3 hours.
Yeah, the core of it. Well, I mean, it should probably take about the same amount of time now that the
it should take less time because you've already done it once.
I don't know about that. I'm always hesitant to say that I learned from my mistakes.
No, it took 3 hours to do 80% of it, and it took 30 hours to do the last 20.
Exactly.
Right.
That's exactly right. Yep. All right, so I guess what I'm hearing is that we believe that the syntax spec is more or less there. There are a couple of issues that we're concerned about, but not so concerned that we want to continue to discuss them in this group before we present them to the RDF working group. So I think I'm hearing that the plan of action is to get the syntax, make one more pass through the syntax spec, make sure that it's up to date, and then tell the RDF working group that we're ready to have it discussed in that group. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
When would you like to kick off the process?
Next week, hopefully. That would be nice to send a spec after this, maybe at this weekend, and then next week we just say, look, start taking a look at it, and then it'll probably take them 2 weeks to look at it if it's made a priority, and then we can, we'll probably start discussing it in that group.
My guess is they'll get comments pretty immediately. So, I mean, in terms of a process of getting us over there, I'd say that sending over, basically sort of formally sending a reference to the doc and say we want to start work with the group, and actually going through the process of getting, I guess it would be Marcus, Nicholas, and I involved in that group to work on it there, I think could sort of move that forward. So
yep. Yeah.
How would this group be a task force, or would it be? Would you have to be a member of the RDF working group?
I don't understand the question. So would this group, as in the JSON for linking data community group, become a task force?
Yeah, or which
it
group
wouldn't,
is
it,
going
we would,
to work?
We would all of us would transplant into the RDF working group. That's
right.
The current proposal. So the community group doesn't have any kind of formal relationship with the standards process, like the W3C process that we should be following. So we need to transplant the work into something that has that, you know, that formalism, and then, you know, we'll kind of go forward from there. This group would just, we would probably stop having telecons for a while, or we would have telecons to finish up the API, and then this group would go into hibernation while we finished up the last bit of it in the RDF working group. And if we are successful with that, we will be the first community group to actually get a RecTrack spec out, which will be pretty amazing. Especially considering, you know, we've technically only operated for a year. It's a really fast spec. So it would be a big success story for the W3C. So I think they want to see us succeed quickly.
Yeah, but then I might have to court some membership organization, because as Yvonne said earlier, it was hard enough to get me into the RDFA working group.
Yeah, those are always an evolving discussion. They are certainly going to ask you. But I think my argument's going to be, look, you know, Nicholas has been involved in the JSON LD stuff since the very beginning of the group, and it would be, it would be an awful thing to not have someone that was involved in the core of it not be able to be represented in the RDF working group. So I think that they would, I don't think it's going to be a problem getting you in, but I think that they are certainly going to want you to press on your organization to do some sort of membership. Basically, do your best, if for whatever reason your organization is not interested, I think I'd still make a very strong argument to have you join.
I think the barrier to entry has been lowered, though. I don't think you can get in. There are different levels of membership that are less expensive than they used to be,
mm-hmm.
so it might not be as difficult to sell at this point.
Yeah.
No, but I'll still... I might be able to use this and my previous work in the RDFA working group as some kind of an interesting point, at least for six, which are, I know at least one person there, and they are members, and they actually represent W3C in Sweden, so ideally I might be able to use this situation as well in many serendipitous ways, so that I can sort of get going on this for real instead of having to work on it on my spare time, because my current employers don't see the value in standardization, and I sort of understand them from their point of view.
Right.
So I'll try to change my situation in favor of being able to work more with this stuff.
That's right. So I guess the end is we will figure out a way to make it work. So I don't think you should be overly concerned about that being an issue.
Right.
It will be an issue, but it's not something that's going to stop us dead in our tracks.
No.
Okay, so we should get into issues since we're 50 minutes into the call and we haven't discussed any issues. But it's good to get a handle on how we think we're going to proceed. First up is issue 100, whether or not we should have a strict mode flag, or a mode strict flag. And there have been two variations of this discussed over the past couple of months. One of them is the first question is whether or not we should have a strict mode or a validate option, or whether or not there should be a mode to the API. The second question is, if there is a mode, should we have two different modes or three different modes? So should it just be strict and lax, or should it be strict and match and lax? So basically strict will raise an error on any kind of mismatch or any kind of thing that's not a perfect JSON-LD, quote-unquote perfect JSON-LD. Match would basically drop any data that seems problematic, and lax would try to coerce certain things, try to do the right thing in many cases. Like if it can figure out what the author's intent was, it'll do the right thing. Otherwise, it'll just leave it alone and allow it to pass through. There's a fourth option that Greg raised that is basically a lint option or a validate option, which is also kind of under discussion. So I guess the first question here is whether or not we actually want there to be different modes for the JSON-LD API. And I guess, Marcus, you've, I think, typically been the person that has felt that we don't necessarily need multiple options. What's your current position on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's more or less still the same because I can't really see the need of it. I mean, it's not something that is intended for human consumption in the first place. It's not, I mean, there will no one be there who notices if some data gets automatically dropped, for example. Like in HTML, you will see that something just doesn't show up, for example. But here, you really probably lose data if you don't throw an exception early enough. And, I mean, we decided last time that kind of the goal of JSON-LD is to be as forgiving as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, honestly, I also don't really understand how those modes should work. Or, I mean, like, what exactly they do in algorithmic terms.
Okay, so I guess the questions about what they should do are the easiest to answer. So the base concern here is that we did start out by saying that JSON-LD should be really forgiving in what it does, and I think that still holds. The default mode should be we don't know what the default mode is, but or we haven't decided that. But in general, we want JSON-LD to be very forgiving. But there are cases where having a forgiving syntax or having a forgiving data coming into your system is not ideal, meaning that it either results in more code complexity or it could result in bad data getting into the system. As you also made a point where you just said that, well, JSON-LD isn't really meant for human consumption. That's not quite accurate, right? I mean, the developers are still going to be looking at this stuff, and there's a reason that a lot of developers, or one of the reasons that a lot of developers really prefer JSON over something like XML or binary or whatever, is that it is readable, right? It is fairly easy to read. So I think that...
Yeah, what I meant with that is that it's not directly rendered to the end user. I wasn't talking about developers.
Okay. So I guess the key concerns here are that we are going to burden a certain subset of developers, the developers that either want there to be a very easy single code path through their code, and in that case, they would say throw an exception when anything weird happens. And then there are developers that might just be, hacking around with something. They don't want, they don't care about bad data. They just want to maybe even just throw something up on a page. And they don't care about the error cases. They just want to do something quick and dirty with it. And those developers would probably prefer something like lax mode. Like, they don't care about the errors. So just do what you can, and I'll use whatever's generated out of that. So
just to make one concrete example, if we are, for example, going in the from RDF, and we are getting in something which is coerced to an, integer, but is spelled out. It's 5 as characters.
Mm-hmm.
What should happen there in different modes?
Well, let's I don't know if that example makes sense because it would never be spelled out in the from RDF works on an RDF model.
Yeah, and if we
right?
get in invalid RDF data.
No, that for instance, what I just wrote in there, you know, that is 5 expressed as an integer. That is valid RDF.
Yep. Yeah, which is why I said it doesn't really make that much sense. There's no such thing as invalid. Now, if you actually,
no, I mean, you can't convert it to a native integer in JSON. That's what I mean by it's not valid.
Right. So you don't.
Yeah. Why do we need different modes then? I mean, that's what I'm trying to understand. I don't see the need for different modes because either we try to coerce it like AB323, which I don't think we should do, but that was proposed somewhere in that comment list. Or we just leave it in there as it is, and, well, that's then up to the developer to deal with that. And compaction wouldn't compact that.
Well, it might be reasonable for someone to, and this might be true for any other RDF syntax as well, is if you see a data type literal that is not in the lexical form of that data type, that would be an exception. And there may be some way to do that in Sparkle that doesn't strike me right now, but you know, I can certainly see value. If I was importing RDF data and I had data that did not match what I expected or what that was at odds with the way it was stated, then throwing an exception in that case might be useful. That would probably be more useful when I'm doing sort of development level work. When I switch to production, I'd probably go to lax because I'm not prepared in a runtime environment to deal with those problems.
I think that I'm not entirely sure how standardized it is, but I think that, for instance, 5 as an integer or strange forms of dates, I've seen when I run Sparkle in Gina, I think that it actually complains about it. I've been able to use Gina, but not Sesame Sparkle, to validate JSON just by running a construct. And if I don't get any result, it means that it was an invalid lexical form. So I'm not entirely sure what the system's doing there, but more to the point, I think that, for instance, well, dirty data is very troublesome in certain cases when I want to use simple code to generate output like markup, and then I would definitely want the match mode because I would want to drop any creator which was just applied as a string value because I want the URI for the creator, and that's
yeah,
a real use case I've seen at times.
Isn't that a use case for framing? If you, for example, if you want to have the IRI instead of the name.
Yeah, but isn't this for both compaction and framing?
Well, I think that generally about JSON-only processors in general, I think.
I think most problems are found in expansion. The problems you find in compaction have to do with seeing issues in a context. And of course, framing, if you see problems in the frame itself, but probably not as much in the document that's being worked on. That
right.
You would find in the expansion phase.
Yeah. Another way to go at this is that, you know, what we've learned with HTML5 is that developers do a lot of really weird things with their markup, and they still expect the document to work. That is, they people really didn't like the draconian error handling that we had with XHTML, right? XHTML1. And XML to a certain degree, but most web developers have used XHTML1, and they really didn't like that their page just stopped working entirely if they had one minor thing out of place.
Yeah, but that is actually a problem with HTML that goes back some time ago, because the tool chains were not required to output, you know, what's Postel's law is be very strict about what you produce and lax about what you receive. Well, there was never that first part involved with HTML,
right.
So it was a Wild West. I think having something that allows someone to be very strict about what they produce in terms of having a way of determining that what they've produced is not pedantic, I think is an important part of that tool chain to make sure we don't get into the Wild West state that HTML has found itself.
Right. Yeah, so I guess that's sort of that's in parallel to the point I was making. One of them is, you know, I think people would like people prefer software systems that recover when they can, right? So that basically tells us we shouldn't have strict mode as the default. But what it also says is that, you know, there are a subset of people that do care about that, right? They do want to be notified when something's out of place. And these are, you know, these people are the more pedantic people, but they're also a lot of the people that are building the software systems, you know, for the web. So they want to deal with fairly clean input, because the code that they have to write for that is far simpler than having to deal with, you know, just effectively, you know, spaghetti code or you know, really, really convoluted markup.
You know, I'd maybe go further and put requirements on toolmakers that the JSON-LD they emit must not generate errors when processed in strict mode.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, yeah. Therefore, I guess my opinion, I really see that there's a strict mode that identifies problems, and then there is the normal or lax mode that basically does its best effort on what's retrieved. I don't really see as strong an argument for something in between, just a lot more complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the problems that are not allowed in strict mode? Could we list them, or, I mean, it's a bit abstract to talk about two flags without knowing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Let me try and see what we're talking about here.
I was a bit confused. I thought we talked about when doing compaction, but...
Well, I think that when we find terms that don't resolve to IRIs, that is an exception condition. And the default mode, of course, is to ignore them. But in a strict mode, that would be identified. And I think it also should be the case that when running in strict mode, you don't stop at the first error. You attempt to find as many errors as possible to report. So any data which is ignored certainly should be flagged in a strict mode.
Yeah, specifically, I guess, Marcus, this all came out of talking about what happens during compaction. Right. So when you have a string value that's FIVE, but has
a
type of XSE integer.
We change compaction quite a bit, so we don't convert the native types to strings anymore, which changes it quite a bit now. Because before we had always a string in at value. Now we don't have that anymore. So now all those problems move to from RDF.
Right. So you're saying, do we have any issues left that require us to have these flags, or did we take care of all of them? I think what Greg just said is still an issue, right? Like if someone puts in a string instead of an actual ID, we'd want a strict mode processor to catch that.
Yeah, I might want a way to shut that up. For instance, if I have ignored data in a context. I mean, it's reasonable for me to just use a JSON document as a context. Yet, when used as a context, all the information in there that's not JSON would would be thrown away, but that's not an error condition. We've also talked about extension modes of the context where you could add some new keyword that would be ignored by processors but could be useful by some specific processor. If that throws an error in strict mode, then it becomes not useful for people to use strict mode that are doing that type of thing. If there's not a way of saying this is okay, I mean, in C, isn't there? Mm-hmm. As I recall, there's some way in C to get lint to shut up for things that you know are okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all the dash W flags, right? I mean, the default is to not warn you when certain things are happening, but you can turn all of those on or turn all
of those
off.
I thought there
off.
Was some pragma you could put in place that would have similar effect in line, but maybe those are specific processors I worked with in the past.
Right. Yeah, I guess that my concern is that if we don't have a way to switch the mode on the processor, then we are assuming a certain way that people are going to be working with the data. And I think that's a dangerous assumption to make.
Far as to have flags that are in line that affect the way the processing works at any given level. So you might want to say in some place it's okay, ignore these types of warnings. And in other places that we should do strict checking.
Yeah. I'm a bit wary of doing that because that seems like it's going a little too far, meaning that we're effectively adding pragma.
Well, framing allows you to add flags in line.
Yeah, but framing is kind of a different beast, I think, than compaction and expansion. Meaning that framing is kind of its own little sub-language, and I'm concerned about having that sub-language or creating a sub-language for turning processor features on or off, and putting it into the main syntax. Right, because so the concern I have it goes back to some of the mistakes I think we made with RDFA, and that's being able to kind of switch processor mode. Like we got to a point in the RDFA working group where we were like, wouldn't it be great if we could just switch the processor mode into one mode and then back to another mode and then to one mode? But the downside of that is that you force developers to keep all of that information in their head. And we're already kind of doing that with the context, right? I mean, you're allowed to kind of switch the context as you go from, level to level. But we're hoping that, at least I'm hoping, that most people don't end up doing that. They just use one top-level context and the rest of their document just uses that context. So I certainly see the usefulness in what you're talking about, Greg, but I'm concerned about adding the complexity of the developer having to run a state machine in their head when they're looking at a JSON-LD document.
But maybe this is just saying that the developer needs, the perceived developer needs for doing this type of checking are potentially not something that we can completely consider within this group, and that this is really the role for other tools, such as an external linter that someone might run on data that would give them some information. Maybe we want to be just very soft and do something similar to what we did in the optimized form of compact, where there's a flag that says do stuff without any normative language that says what should be done. And that basically then gives implementers a hook to use that as a basis for doing their own linters or pedantic checkers.
Yeah, that's always an option. It might be best to do that. I think Marcus's question, though, is that's an important one, right? Exactly what are we talking about here? Exactly what kind of errors are we talking about throwing in strict mode?
The other way to do that is there are a class of errors that we can anticipate, and then implementers are encouraged to provide more explicit checks that go beyond that. But that sort of provides a basis. Since I think it does come back to trying to give developers a way of ensuring that the data that they produce is okay. It actually simplifies the tool chain if you're not having to build all that checking in the base generation code. But if you can offload that to a processor that's running in strict mode that will at least have some ability to tell you of problems, then that the marketplace can decide to build on that if that becomes more useful.
Right.
Well, but still I think we should first come up with the list and then discuss based on that, because otherwise, I mean, what should we decide on?
Yeah, well, I mean, the decision would be whether or not we want to have a strict mode flag. That's the first question.
Yeah, but for what if we don't have...
Yeah, so I would say that a strict mode flag, it probably has some slightly different behaviors depending upon the API. So strict mode flag applied to anything which makes use of expansion would warn about ignored data, either properties or values. Strict mode flag in compaction would perform the expansion results and then report about problems in the context or problems in applying the context to the data. And then in framing, it would warn you about syntax issues in the frame, as well as problems that are encountered in the framing, in addition to the work that it does in expansion and compaction tests. The data type checking comes into the RDF conversion when you're going from RDF into JSON-LD, and that probably depends upon how we decide to flag the transformation. If integers, doubles, booleans are to be transformed into native types or not, we perhaps only need to raise an error if you said to transform those types, but they cannot be represented in native form.
Yep.
Marcus,
so
does that seem useful, Marcus? Is that specific enough?
Well, I mean, I can see the use case in from RDF, for example, but beyond that, I'm not really sure.
So
you're not really sure as you can't see the issue, or you're not sure that the issue is strong enough to warrant a strict mode flag?
I mean, I could see a strict mode flag in the from RDF algorithm, which probably is born about, I don't know, native data types which are not matching the lexical representation. But having a strict mode flag for compaction or expansion or, I don't know, maybe even framing, I don't really see how it should be used there or for what it should be used there.
Well,
I think that if, as Marcus and I wrote in the IRC, if using a context and terms with coercion means that you have, well, the effect of match is already in place at least, so the consumers of compacted data wouldn't get dirty data because the dirty data would never be compacted. Is that what you're saying also, Marcus?
Yes, in the example you posted, it's like that. Because we never choose a term whose type isn't matching the data, so it would stay with the full IRI in there. So yes.
Yeah. So at least matching is sort of already in place by definition of how compaction works.
Right. I guess the other question I have, Marcus, is like what happens when you do what I just typed in IRC, ID colon 5, the number 5? What happens in that case? Like, isn't that an error? I mean, in strict mode, I would say that would certainly be an error.
It might be an error in lax mode, too. I mean, there are cases where if we see something, the spec says to throw an error, throw an exception. Maybe in lax mode, we don't throw exceptions for that stuff.
That's
just ignored. Yeah.
That's what I wanted to clarify last week, but I had some problems to describe that. So that was about the allowed value space, which is probably more the grammar. So I would like to see a section document which says, for at ID, the only value can be a string. Otherwise, we throw an exception. And
okay,
then
but what if people want to still consume documents like that? What if there's some data in there that you want to?
It's common for people to use things like IDs for. Or numbers for IDs. The latest stuff I'm seeing out of the Wikidata folks would do this. I've suggested that perhaps the way to deal with that is with the JSON-LD macros, which is something that this group might want to look at a little bit more thoroughly sometime. And I think Marcus had a similar issue that came up at www, where people need a way to be able to provide some form of URI templates in order to be able to get data into a format that allows it to be JSON-LD.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, but if we just have that ID5, we can translate it to a string. What if ID is false or true? I mean, there's nothing you could do. So, and I think as soon as we throw an exception, the better it is in this case, for example.
Well, what happens if that ID5 is in a 80 megabyte document, right? All of a sudden, you just throw an exception and stop processing that document, and that's bad,
right?
Because you have when you pull data off of the web, you can certainly get into you've got a large chunk of data that you've retrieved across a variety of different websites. There's one data item that's wrong, and so because of that, your JSON-LD processor just completely it stops processing. It throws an exception. And I think that is certainly not what we want to happen. And I think it's the likelihood of it happening, especially as JSON-LD becomes more widely adopted, is it just rises, right? The likelihood of you hitting a bad piece of data.
But if we throw exceptions consistently here, then such data wouldn't get produced in the first place, I believe at least.
I think that was
always
the
forgiving, too forgiving, and that's why now they have all those issues with HTML5 to specify exactly how browsers handle all those corner cases and invalid HTML fragments.
I think that the XHTML toolchain was very specific about throwing errors, like XML was very, very, very specific about throwing errors, and we still have documents out there that have XML errors and XHTML errors that are consumed, right? Because there were large companies that ended up creating those documents, like it was just a developer that was like probably a college student that ended up implementing it, and then they left, and they put the system live. And now you have to go and you have to read, we've hit this problem, you have to go and read SOAP documents that have syntax errors in them, right? And in order to deal with that, you have to have this completely other tool chain that is now reads the attempts to try and read the XML, even if there's not a closing, mismatched tag or things of that nature. So I don't believe that even if we threw an exception, that would solve many of the data problems, many of the data encoding problems that are out there. I think that people find amazing ways of creating corrupt data and putting it out there on the web.
And in those cases, either we throw an exception or we ignore it. But
right.
Well, actually, the other mode of operation is that you do both. Is you save the data. The data when you're processing it, you save the error state when you're processing, ignore the data, continue to process, and at the end of processing, you generate an exception with all of the problems that you encountered, or you do it through some other error reporting mechanism.
Right.
I think in RDFA, typically we don't throw exceptions. We put stuff into a processor graph, and then then you can look at the process. If you can choose to look at the processor graph and see all of the errors that were encountered in processing. I don't know if we want to introduce a processor graph notion in here, because you could only do that with an RDFA mode anyway. But the concept of basically some normative way of collecting and reporting errors, I think, is useful. I also probably want the ability to abort early, because if I'm processing a 5 gigabyte document, I probably don't want to wait an hour to find out that there were any problems in there. I want to know, in the first 100 bytes.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that it's pretty clear that we do need a flag, and we can identify some cases for which it should check, and that in the absence of that flag, or at least in the lax mode of that flag, a processor should not generate exceptions. It should do the best effort of production, and provide some way of notifying the user that there are problems that are encountered. Maybe there's a callback rather than an exception mechanism. And then it's up to the application to either say to provide something to use for that callback and then generate its own exception, or do its own error logging. And that based on the return from that callback, it either aborts processing or ignores data.
Yeah, in fact, I think I like that approach much better, because then the decision for what to do when an error's hit is completely up to the person that's writing the application, right?
Instead of adding a flag, the API mechanisms take an optional extra callback
on error,
or in the call. I think they're all defined with callbacks right now, and that there is some way of indicating in the parameters to that callback that this is an error condition. That's the way I typically do it in Ruby, since Ruby makes it, and many other languages make it really easy to have a single closure that is associated with the data, and then I'll branch based upon the arguments provided to that to do different types of things.
Okay, so I guess that would mean that if you don't specify on error, then it's effectively in lax mode. It allows many, many things to kind of go through. And if you have an on error thing specified, then it's kind of a strict mode, but it's left up to the developer on how strict you're going to be.
Yeah, but what I was just suggesting was actually not an on error parameter, but to use the existing callback parameter and then include it as arguments that are provided to that callback.
Hmm.
So the RDF, the
Sorry.
The from RD, RDF, I, or, let's see, one of these, let me find an example document that does this. So if we look at expand has a callback, right? Yes. So the callback is processing when processing is complete on the given input. Actually, that doesn't sound right. Well, all these things are a type of JSON LD callback. And JSON LD callback gets a object or object array is what it's called with. So we could add another flexible type that could be called in there. Object or object array or warning. And if the type that was called was a warning, that's how it would process it accordingly.
How would that look like?
Well, so right now the interface for JSON LD callback accepts a single parameter, which is
I understand that, but how do you notify that callback about which error exactly occurred, or how would I say the value of an at ID was an integer instead of a string, for example?
Well, now you're getting down into the detail of how we report different types of errors, and I think it would probably be done similar to what we had done before with specific exception classes that were triggered, which are ignored now. So it would be a similar mechanism where there would be a subtype of the warning type that would include more detail about that particular problem, very much like we had different types of data that could be reported on a given exception.
So it's basically just a constant, not really the data which was causing the problem.
I think it's the constant.
It could be. It could be part of the data that the callback gets, right? You could always report back, this was the key and this was the value that had the issue. Meaning that the data that we put into the callback, that we give the callback, can have everything that's required in order to, let the developer decide what they need to do. I mean, we could go all the way to including the entire document in the callback. Not that I think we want to do that, but...
Well, I think it might be useful to have some form of a locator using a JSON LD pointer, something like that,
CSS. People are working
path.
On it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If there was the equivalent of a CSS path in JSON LD, and you could just construct it as basically a JavaScript object path,
mm-hmm.
that would be a useful way of being able to report an error location. Then there would be some form of a type of the error, and then there would be at minimal some message associated with the error, and then based upon the class of error, perhaps there's some other data provided as well. Just like there was in an exception, as I recall.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean we could basically follow. I mean you could think of events, basically HTML. JavaScript mouse click events, that the event object that you get has all of the information that you need to kind of process that event. And maybe we could call these aren't exceptions, they are just events. It's a warning event or an error event, and then that event has the type, a message, and then other information, as Greg said, about that would be associated with certain types of errors and events. Marcus, would you be more okay with doing something like that than having a processor mode?
Yeah, I would be more okay with doing that, but I would still like to see the list of what we are handling here. I mean, like, for example, if we have a remote context and I can't retrieve that, is that just a warning then, or should I stop expanding, or?
Well, it's an event, and it's sort of like a bubble. It's sort of like maybe there's some event bubbling, certainly in a JavaScript context. Perhaps that's the way it's handled. But if once you've done that, then you can decide to abort from the callback if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think Marcus is right. We need to specify what we think the proper behavior is for this stuff. But I don't think that there's any question about there being a list. There is more that list contains more than at least one item, right? So for example, if you can't retrieve the JSON-LD document the context, that's an event, and in general, you should probably abort at that point. I don't even know if we should say that, but there's certainly an event. So the idea here is that we have a mechanism in JSON-LD for reporting events back, processing events, and then the developer can decide on what the severity of that event is. So that's one way we can look at it. The other way is that we list the default severity level for these events, like stop processing. Would be one such thing, or raise an exception could potentially be some other way that we deal with this. But I think the core question is, should we have events or should we not have events? Should we have a mode strict flag or should we not? And I think I'm at least convinced of Greg's argument that we should use events, mainly because I think that it addresses Marcus's concern and it gives the developer a lot more power over when the processor should stop and when it should continue.
Yeah, I think if the JSON-LD callback, which just defines a single function, JSON-LD, which is a void return, if instead of being a void return, it's some other return, it can probably Boolean. If it returns true, processing continues. If it returns false, processing stops. And if you want to raise an exception, you do that from within the callback.
Right. Okay. So, Nicholas, do you have any feelings on this one way or the other, Dave Lane?
No, I think that your reasoning sounds good.
Okay.
I agree with the callback.
Okay.
I have no strong notions.
Okay, so JSON-LD will support a JSON-LD processor event mechanism that will report certain events to be decided later via a callback given through JSON-LD API calls. So is that okay for a proposal?
In general, yeah. I think we're going to want to be more specific about if it basically extends the existing JSON-LD callback mechanism or it's something different.
Right. I guess we can.
And if you think about the JavaScript you want to generate, do you want to have two functions that are arguments or one?
Right. And I think we could probably get away with just saying it's just one. Well, let's see. It's a statement callback.
There's a statement callback in 2RDF. And everything else, I think, is a JSON-LD callback.
Okay.
So in the statement callback, it accepts a statement, but it could be accepts a statement or error. In a JSON-LD callback, it would be object or object array or error.
Right.
Well, I think it would make sense to have two different callbacks. Otherwise, you have an if in the callback all the time.
Yeah, that's true. So do we want to actually make this a part of the option that's passed in? And just minimize the number of parameters you need to pass into like expand.
But what should happen if I don't set it? What's the default behavior?
Yeah, we still need to discuss that.
Well, I think the way that we formally define these things is that the APIs don't return anything. The API calls don't return anything. Everything is done through a callback. But it's common. I know Dave's done this for his processors. I've done it for my processor, that in fact I do return the same thing that I would call back, because it's convenient to do in that mode. But when specifying the API, you can't make that assumption, because you want to be able to operate in an asynchronous mode anytime there could be an external context or document involved. So I think there pretty much always, at least formally, has to be a callback to all of these API methods.
So that means we can't separate them. That means that we can't separate them? That's what I understood from Greg.
Well, all I've said is that all of these have a required argument, which is a callback, in the specification of the API. In an actual implementation, you might choose to do something different. In the case of Ruby, if I call compact without a callback, then I will get the return value of what would have been the single call to the JSON-LD callback. But I think within the definition of the spec here, if we update the description of when the callback parameter is used, it is used right now for compact. It's used when processing complete on the given input, or an exceptional condition is noted, and that the return value from that is used to determine whether processing is aborted or continues.
I can go either way.
That would be almost all of these things.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, I think Marcus is right. You know, if you would always have an if statement in that callback to check to see if it's an error or if it's actually done. And I'm wondering if we should just split it into two different things and say, well, if you want to be very specific about how you handle errors, then there's a JSON-LD option or events. So you can specify in the JSON-LD options an event handler, and then that would allow events. And you wouldn't need, an if statement in there, and it would be fairly clean. You would always know that you're getting in some kind of event, and you need to operate on that event, whereas the JSON-LD callback is although I guess you could say that there's the event that you handle, you're always handling events in the callback, and you just need to figure out if the event is finished processing or there's a warning detected or something.
Well, what is an event in WebIDLE? Is it not just a callback? Is there some other way to...
It's just a callback. It's just a callback.
Yeah. So we have a callback, and that is equivalent to saying that all of these APIs are event-based. So it's just a different type of event.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Basically, it would be an end event versus a warning event or cannot dereference.
There's warning and error events, I guess, and you could say that the difference between them is that an error event is one in which the processor will never continue, and a warning is one in which the processor may be able to continue processing. But whether it continues or not is dependent upon the return value from that from the call.
Will I say that again, Greg? Whether or not
whether the processor continues after the event is issued or the callback is called is dependent upon the return value from that callback.
Right. Yeah.
True.
Yeah,
or
I
false.
Agree with. Yeah, I agree with that. I thought you were saying something different, like saying we should have three a tri-state response. So, zero
no.
means no error. Continue. One means, you know. Well, I'm wondering if one of them meant, you know, throw an exception, and the other one meant ignore.
Well, I think if you want to throw an exception, the
you do it yourself.
The, you do it yourself.
Yeah. Okay. And that sounds reasonable to me as far as a design approach to this. I'm still somewhat on the fence about whether or not the callback should just be. We basically have an event handler, and you register an event handler with the call, and then your event handler decides whether or not, you know, your event handler just handles all events from processing, which means, you know, you couldn't dereference it, all errors, and whether or not the document has finished processing.
And just posted an example from the WebSocket interface. They, for example, they separate it. So they have an on error and an on message event.
I just think that's just idiomatically clumsy, though.
Yeah, just wanted to have a look.
I mean, I think in a perfect world, yes, it makes sense to sort of separate these concerns. But practically speaking, it doesn't correspond with the way that I actually write programs.
Why not?
Well, in the case of Ruby, it's because Ruby has, you know, a block method. So I can pass a block to most things, and then I deal with it in the block. In JavaScript, certainly you can pass multiple functions. But I think that makes for the code paths to be quite difficult because you've sort of separated, you end up having the processing separated sort of spatially throughout the document, which makes it a little bit more difficult to deal with. I mean, you could do it in Ruby with bypassing a lambda and doing it more in line with that. It just isn't the way that it typically works. I think, not sure about Python, but I suspect Python's fairly similar as well, that it works better to have a single block that's associated with the method
processing
that you're invoking than multiple blocks.
Yeah. So basically, if as your code gets more complicated, you could potentially want to do more things whenever there's a warning or there's an error or whether, you know, a socket's opened, and you end up having to implement every single one of those callbacks anyway. So in the most complex case, what Greg said happens, your code ends up kind of all over the document, and you have to, when you want to mess with what happens when there's an error, you go to a different part of the document than when the socket's opened versus, you know, something else. And even in the newbie kind of the starting case, you really, for a developer that's just getting started with this stuff, you want something simple. You don't want to kind of overwhelm them with options. So just give them one path through the code, right? Just say, okay, when you call this, you have a callback. This callback is called whenever an event happens, whenever a processing event happens. If you don't want to deal with errors or issues like that, then just always return true, and here's the tiny bit of code that you need to put in there for dealing with the final data that you get from the callback. I do think that Greg has a point in that it's certainly simpler like that. So basically, with the JSON-LD processor, you tell it to do something, and then you give a callback to what happens when it has something an event for you to process, and then the end of processing is also that event. So it's just one function for basically everything. And if you need to break it down in different functions because it's very complicated, you can do that. You make the decision to do that, just as you make the decision on whether or not the JSON-LD processor should continue. I like that approach because it gives a lot of power to the developer without really complicating things, I think. Thoughts, Marcus, Nicholas, Evelyn?
Well, I'm currently looking at some APIs, and basically all of them use distinct callbacks.
Mm-hmm.
The geolocation API, WebWorkers, WebSockets, all of them.
Keep in mind that all of those were designed by the same person.
Yeah, but I mean, and there should be some consistency, nevertheless.
But are those, I mean, this is for parsing. It's just an event listener for the parser events. So I think that starting off with just a function, getting the type of the event, and or just an object which is type and message in one, is simple to start off with until we see the use cases build up and realize that everybody will have to pay the same price if we just do this. Then we should add distinct callbacks if we see that it reduces complexity for the general case.
Yeah, if you look at go to the WebSockets. Sorry, Nicholas. That was an argument for basically starting off with just an event mechanism and making it more complex if we need to.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. If you look down at the WebSockets interface or the WebSockets document, I just think this is interesting. I'm not making an argument one way or the other, but if you go down to event definitions, this is how they specify the events. So there's a close event and a close event init that are called. And I would expect us to we would follow that, I think. Follow that example for the event definitions.
Yeah.
I like that because it seems fairly clean and simple for people to start off with. So we don't have to have all these, you know, we don't have to have mode strict lax and all those. We don't have to have those. And you know what? We could actually give options to the developers on how they wanted resolve. So, for example, if someone puts in the value true and they put in an XSD integer, when that event comes back to the person, we could potentially return what the correct key value pair should be for that, or the data should be for that. Again, not saying that we should do that, but this gives us the option of doing that. So you can make the decision on how you want the data to be corrected.
Yeah.
That would make the return type a bit more complex. That's the only downside to that.
Yeah, I think that maybe is something else that we might go to, but I would start off by doing the simplest thing that could possibly work, right?
Right.
And then we make it more complex based upon evidence.
Okay, so the event mechanism would be called for JSON LD processor event callback would be registered for every JSON LD API call and would provide the type of event and data associated with the event, the callback. And this mechanism would be used to report potential errors, warnings, and when the processing of the document is complete.
what happens if we have something that can't be solved?
What do you mean can't be solved?
Like, for example, having at ID and the value of that is an at value object, for example. Should that end up in the expanded output then if someone returns true there? Or?
I think that's a different question, I think, right? But it would be ignored effectively, I think, or in this mechanism. They would either return true or false, and if they said true, like continue, then what we would have to do is ignore it. Right, because that's the only way to continue. I don't know if, I mean, you could argue that we would convert it to a string and treat it as a relative IRI. That's another way that we could deal with that.
So we would basically have kind of an event type, which is like, I don't know, failure or, I don't know, unresolvable issue or something like that.
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, there's an argument that it's not necessarily an unresolvable issue because we could resolve it by ignoring it, or we could resolve it by coursing it to a string and treating it as a relative IRI. So we still need to have that discussion, but I think the general notion is that they would get a warning to say, look, we just hit something that's bad, and then depending on what we believe. If they say that's okay, continue, then we need to decide what the processor should do at that point. But at that point, what they're basically telling you is you need to continue regardless of that data. So the processor would either coerce it to a relative IRI or it would ignore it.
And one thing that I might want to do is say stop processing the subtree.
Right,
which might argue for more than just a Boolean return value.
Right. Yep. Okay, so I think this is issue 100. I think we've basically decided whether or not we should have a mode strict flag. We've decided that we should not, and that expansion. We don't have a mode strict flag, but instead we have an event mechanism that's called back to. And then depending on the return value of the event, we decide whether or not we want to continue or not. Okay. Does that resolve that issue?
I think the other, the corollary to that is that in the existing places where we say that a processor should raise an exception, that instead it should be a callback, and then
right.
and stop processing if the callback returns false.
Yep. Yeah.
It'd be good to have plus ones on that just so that it's in the log.
Okay, so proposal when a JSON LD processor processes input that would result in an exception. It should instead call the JSON LD processor event callback with the issue with data. Well, does that seem all right?
Yeah.
So Marcus, you're saying for only for browser implementations, or are you saying for all implementations?
I'm saying for browser implementations, because in some languages you probably don't do callbacks. Like PHP, for example, I would never do a callback there because it just doesn't make sense.
Hmm. With most other languages, you'd have closures or something there, right?
At least an event listener with just a handle method.
Right.
Shouldn't that work in PHP as well?
Yeah, I mean, you could do it for the error case, but I mean, I would always like to have my return value as the return value and block, because I don't have multiple threads. So.
And again, I mean, I think that's kind of it's an implementation detail. And if for example, I don't know if we really, if we have 90% of the languages can use a callback, or, and I'm pretty sure PHP can as well, right? I don't think
we need of course, a callback, but a callback, what does it do? I mean, it depends on the implementation, how you design the implementation. But
yeah, and I mean, it might mean that we need something that's basically saying this is a non-recoverable error. There may be errors in here that are just completely non-recoverable, like, for example, the JSON-LD processor hid garbage, and it can't make sense out of the rest of the document. That would be an example of a completely unrecoverable error.
In many cases, it'll just be the JSON parser that does that.
Yep.
Yeah, I never see anything. I can't give you any more detail.
Right. Okay. All right. Really quickly on issue 81, I'm confused as to, I don't know what's still holding us up on that issue. It's resolved.
Resolved?
It is resolved. I don't know why I have it on the... Was that recently resolved? Maybe not.
Last week.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Then issue 110, I think, is resolved. I must have put a lot of these issues on there that have already been resolved. Well, 110 is more specific frame matching.
I don't think we have enough time for that.
No, we don't.
We probably should.
No, there's a whole bunch of frame stuff.
Yeah. Well,
it would really be useful if it's possible when we're getting into some deep frame stuff, to maybe do an alternative call time when Dave Longley could be available.
Yeah.
That might help a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Maybe is issue 116 fairly quick? Do we want to introduce an extension keyword? I don't think we do. Dave Longley doesn't feel very strongly about it. He just raised it as a potential way that we could provide people with a way of saying that they've created a JSON-LD extension. But I think any extension to JSON-LD should just go through this community and be standardized.
I think we determined that if this extension mechanism was added, that it would just be ignored by processors right now. And so
right.
You really don't need to do anything. Okay. In fact, in this case, it probably would generate a warning, which then a particular processor or developer could ignore or do something. That's one way to allow them to provide a hook to do something.
Right.
I think we might want to actually talk about that at some point, because part of it was how to put in other metadata there for validation. And I don't know if anyone's really looked at how to do that.
Do validation?
I can't remember exactly all the thoughts I had on it before, but...
Right. Well, I mean, that's certainly something that we're not doing.
Well, yeah, we probably don't want to put it into the JSON-LD itself, but to provide a mechanism such that other tools can do it. And I don't know, it was kind of unclear whether you could actually fit that into the current constructs. Since it's not really direct data, it's not really context data either, it's something else.
Right.
The JSON-LD processor would just ignore it, and on top of that, you can do with it what you want.
Yeah, and in particular, if it provides a pointer to the location of it, that could be pretty useful. We don't necessarily, we haven't defined a way in which you could actually affect any processing from that, but I think this is a good start.
Right. Yeah, I guess what the point that Dave Lane is making is that we almost inevitably, people are going to want to validate their input in some way, and we've looked at JSON schema. We've looked at, you know, a couple of other mechanisms. I know Dave Lane's implemented our entire validation suite, and it is not a trivial task, but it is something that can be encoded in JSON pretty easily. So I don't think that we've, correct me if I'm wrong, Lane, but I don't think we've done anything in JSON-LD that would prevent us from having a validation mechanism kind of injected into the context or into the document. But I think that, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I can correct one thing, is that I don't think our JSON validator is easy at all, but, you know, that's...
Well, it works.
Yeah, it works, but I think it's kind of, we need to iterate on that some more before we come up with something that actually is more generally useful.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure how that just would integrate into the context. I mean, if you have like a generic extension mechanism or whatever that was just ignored by everyone else and allowed you to have your own thing, that is one way that we can just have people experiment with it. I don't know if that's the way we want to go forward. I'm pretty sure we don't want to force any particular validation mechanism on anyone, but it's just something we probably need to discuss a little bit and experiment with. Some, because there might be, at least my theory is that there's probably better ways to do validation than what we're doing, since we're doing it based on trees, and it may be that there's a more semantic web type schema thing that operates more on triples that may be better to actually validate the data, and I don't know if anyone's actually done that sort of work yet.
I recently used Sparkle 1.1 and the Schemarama approach, which is sort of 10 years old ID, which kind of works very nicely to do all kinds of data type and domain specific checking all rolled in one. But that's purely on the RDF level.
Yeah, I think I haven't. I think I saw that many years ago. I don't know exactly what it is, but I'm sure there's a bunch of research and other projects that we should look at before we when we try this sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I guess the key point here is that I don't think we've done anything to prevent a schema mechanism to be injected into JSON-LD. It would just be another, like, you know, at validate or whatever, if we wanted to do that. But it seems like we don't really even have a very good idea on how we should tackle the task yet. So.
No, I mean, I think for starters, it's the sort of thing that could actually doesn't even need to be in line. Maybe.
Yeah, but you could either point to a separate document, or you can just have the document completely external. It's like a completely different part. You know, JSON-LD is how you do the syntax and markup, but the validation is a completely separate subsystem.
Yeah. There's probably some way that
we're all going to drop off in a minute.
Yeah.
Well, I've been on the least time, so I think I'll hold the call for a bit.
Okay. Well, we might as well end the call. I think we're done with the issues. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for scribing this long time, Greg.
No problem.
All right, and we'll talk again next week.
All right.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Manu.
Yeah.
We don't have an RDFA telecom this week, right?
No, we do not. Nope.
Okay. Good.
Yep.
Great. Talk to you later then. Bye.
Is it over now?
Yep.
Yeah. It's done. So talk to you next week.
So we don't talk about this. We don't resolve this issue. Or what was the last thing you talked about?
I
for the extension thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've actually come to a resolution for that yet.
No, I didn't hear any specific decision. I think that we're leaning on just closing it and relying on the fact that we can add just about anything.
Yeah, I think everyone agrees on that, so we should resolve it. Yeah, Manu comes back, I think.
Yeah. Okay, we do it like this. Looks good. Oh, well. We'll see.
Yeah, okay.
We might
have a nice
take
week.
A... Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.
Bye.